The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Dennis O'Hare here, in your feed this week with an extra helping of political breakfast. Now, you might have heard there are primary elections coming up May 22nd. Georgia Democrats and Republicans will head to the polls to pick the Pauls, who will compete to be the state's next governor. In advance of the primaries, I've been sitting down with all of the major party candidates to get their views for the state. And you can look for those interviews Wednesdays and Fridays in our podcast feed. This is the next interview in that series with Republican Michael Williams. Now, he's a certified public accountant. He's represented a district in Forsyth County in the state Senate for the past 4 years. Senator, welcome.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It's great to be here.
Now, you have called for big cuts in state spending. A lot of your competitors in the GOP primary have done the same. So how would that work in your case, and how would it be different?
We had a debate recently where we were all asked specifically what departments would we cut to help reduce the size of government.
Well, that was going to be my next question, so start with that one.
Well, perfect. The reason I bring that up was I was the only candidate on that stage that could actually identify a department that I was going to cut, as well as specific instances where we can actually reduce the budget. The department that I identified was the Governor's Office of Student Achievement. It sounds like a really nice department, so why would you want to cut the department, the Governor's Office of Student Achievement?
Well, it monitors how local districts are doing in terms of test scores and performance.
Well, it's also a power grab by the Governor's Office to take control over education. And we have an education department. You know, we have a Board of Education that's appointed by the governors, as well as an elected state school board superintendent. So I believe in streamlining processes, and we don't need a separate office in the governor's office to monitor students. We have our own Department of Education, so everything that I'd like to do in that area would be in conjunction with the Department of Education.
Now, recall when that was set up, mm-hmm. and the argument at the time was, look, Georgia is consistently near the bottom of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia when it comes to student performance, and we need to be able to identify districts that are having trouble and get them help. So what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that idea, but how much better is Georgia doing? We're still towards the bottom. So again, it was merely a power grab by the governor's office to take that. And we still need to focus on the districts. We need to focus on the child, the education needs that they have. But let's do it within the Department of Education, and let's do it at the local levels to make sure that our children are getting the education they need.
And then there's the question of revenue that the state forgoes. You said at a recent GOP debate that you're not crazy about tax breaks to lure Amazon's second headquarters, just to name one. Does that mean that you would consider reviewing or eliminating all loopholes and tax credits?
I am not in favor of tax breaks in general. I think it's picking winners and losers. It's crony capitalism. It's not a good way to do business. You'll hear probably many politicians that you bring in, many of the candidates running for governor, talk about how Georgia's the number one state in the country to do business. I hear it time in and time out. I've been traveling the state, talking to small business owners. I have had yet one of them to tell me they feel that way. The reason Georgia's the number one state in the country to do business is because we are great at giving away tax credits to these large businesses, rolling out the red carpet for them to come in because they've been picked by the governor, and they're treated very well because they're the governor's hand-chosen one. But for rest of Georgia, for the small businesses out there, we need to eliminate our state income tax. We need to deregulate. We need to make it easier for small businesses to thrive, not just big business.
But don't the people who come with those businesses generate revenue for the economy, whatever the tax break for the state might have been, don't they stimulate the economy and simply by normal economic processes add jobs and economic growth?
Two things on that. Yes, they do. Again, going in with Amazon, with the numbers that are being thrown out there, it's $200,000 a job. At a 5.75% income tax rate, that's going to take a very, very long time. My calculation is over 100 years to get that back. That's just not a wise investment. Also, with that argument, you're assuming that Atlanta and Georgia has an unlimited amount of growth that we have. Well, we can only handle so much, and we're already growing very fast. So if we can create organic growth at very little to no cost, why do we want to pay billions of dollars to bring in businesses to Georgia?
Speaking of taxes, you have proposed eliminating the state income tax. The replacement, I'm assuming, then would be a sales tax.
That would be part of it.
Yeah. How would that be structured, though?
Our budget has gone from $15 billion in 2010 to about over $26 billion this last budget that we proposed.
And our population continues to grow.
It does, but it hasn't grown 71%. Mm-hmm. Our population has gone up, inflation has gone up, but again, even when you factor those in, it's not 71%, which is what the state budget has done.
But the argument has been, especially during the recession, we put off spending on things that we really need to spend on, like infrastructure, like transit, like rural development, all sorts of things.
Yes and no. The reason I'm going to say that is because I've been able to dive in to our budget. And I looked at how we were spending our money pre-recession and how we're spending our money post-recession. And one of the things that just really bugged me because, in all honesty, I voted for a tax increase. I'll explain here in a minute. The politicians, they chose to spend their money elsewhere and not invest it in core principles such as transportation. So as the budget started to rise from the recession, the level of spending for transportation did not rise at the same rate that the budget was, with the anticipation that they would go to the people and increase the gas tax. So you're correct. But at the same time, because of mismanagement, I know that we can do a lot better with what we have. Also, has education gone up 71%? Has our ability to move around the state, transportation improvements, have they improved 71%? There's no correlation, the amount of money that the state is collecting to the result and the job that they're doing.
So back to how a state sales tax would work.
It's going to be a combination of, one, eliminating a lot of the waste that we've already talked about. Again, over about $1 billion that we can eliminate every year, as well as expanding in some of the industries. You look at offshore drilling. It's something that Republicans have wanted for 20, 30 years, ever since Ronald Reagan. We now have the ability to do offshore drilling. Texas, they don't have a state income tax. Florida doesn't have a state income tax. The big part of Texas not having a state income tax is the oil and gas industry. Florida said they don't want to do any offshore drilling. If Georgia can take a leadership role in offshore drilling while protecting our beaches, I know there's some talk out there about how are we going to do that, and at the same time,
now we have industries along that coastline that themselves depend on clean water and an undisturbed environment there.
Correct. And you look at the beaches on the Gulf Coast. Have you ever been to Destin? Is that some of the most beautiful beaches in the world, crystal blue water, and they have drilling there in the Gulf of Mexico. So it is very possible to have both. And as we expand our industries and offset some of that lost revenue in conjunction with the decrease in the wasteful spending, then you go ahead and you add the fair tax model, which is consumption-based.
But the assumption here on the oil and gas drilling is that fossil fuels will continue to be in demand. And with alternative energy taking up more and more of the energy sector, is that a safe assumption?
In the next 40 to 50 years, absolutely. 100 years from now, I don't know, but by then we'll be dead and gone.
Speaking of Florida, you mentioned Florida doesn't have a state income tax. It did, though, have a budget crisis triggered in part by Hurricane Irma, which changed the state's budget picture dramatically, partly because it was relying on sales tax. And when that economic opportunity goes down and you're relying on one source instead of sort of a balanced mix of state income sources, aren't you asking for trouble if something bad happens?
Well, again, you look at the amount of coastline that Georgia has, as well as the tourism that
I was using Irma as an example. If you have any kind of economic bad event or several that could cause the state to lose economic activity, shouldn't you have a balance of revenue sources like property taxes to help cushion the impact of that?
Well, again, with the mix of revenue, you're never going to be 100% shielded from disaster or from financial crisis. We had one in 2008, 2009. The way that you shield that is through having a strong reserve, a healthy, streamlined business organization as well. So, and right now, Georgia has close to $4 billion reserve account for that. And with me as governor, we definitely have a more efficient government.
The state legislature recently passed what amounts to a reduction in the state income tax. Isn't that, and the economic activity that would be generated from that presumably, an example of, okay, we've got a pretty good, solid, balanced system here?
I like to point out that the only reason that we were able to reduce the state income tax was because of the federal tax breaks that were signed into law by Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And you're a supporter of President
Absolutely.
Trump.
Absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
Doesn't, I guess my question remains, isn't President Trump's tax reform plan feeding into a state system that others might argue ain't broke, so why fix it?
Well, again, I guess let me explain a little bit better. The state was going to get a massive windfall of what should have gone to the citizens of Georgia. So it wasn't that the Trump tax breaks proposed all this economic growth at will, but this particular instance was not as a result of that. It was that the state was getting money that should have gone to its citizens. So the state could have kept that money. I'm glad we didn't. I'm glad we're going to give part of it back, but we're still going to have a big windfall, just not as much. So to say that we're reducing our state income tax because we're being more effective and more efficient in running government is not a fair statement. It's not correct. Again, this whole thing came about because the state was getting money that should have gone to the citizens, and we're just allowing it to pass through.
Let's take education as an example then. Governor Deal's new fiscal 2019 budget includes full funding for the state's quality basic education formula, which everyone in both parties agrees needs to be looked at. So let's just talk about what happens in the meantime. Would a sales tax, relying simply on a sales tax, just not be a reliable source of funding for instance, schools?
Well, again, when a recession or when a catastrophe occurs, when something bad happens, both sales and personal income is affected. Whenever we went through the 2008 crisis, it wasn't just sales tax that was affected. It was income tax as well. So, again, it's not necessarily the mix because people can't spend what they don't make. It's more how are we managing our state and how are we preparing for those days that are going to be trials in the future.
The new budget that the governor just got passed includes the full funding for QBE, the state's quality basic education formula. And we have, and everybody says, yeah, that needs to be looked at. But in the meantime, would you continue to fully fund QBE until it is looked at and revised?
Funding of education, again, that model is archaic, out of date, mm-hmm. and that would be a major priority of mine, is to make sure that the money that we give to education is actually going towards the teachers, to the pupils, to the students, to those that actually need the money. Whenever I look at education, the thing that just really drives me crazy is the amount of money that's spent in the administrative level of education. There's way too much money spent in that level. More of that needs to go get into the classroom.
So how would you revise the formula?
Oh, I'd like to pass on that question. Again, that formula is very convoluted.
But we have had study committees that have been going for a while.
We have.
They have not been able to come up with something that would get through the legislature.
Well, to do that, you've got to have a strong governor that is willing to take criticism, that's willing to, because in doing that, there's going to be people that are going to love it. There's going to be people that aren't going to like it, because in changing it, there's going to be winners and losers. And the problem is going to be, how do you rectify to the best you can those that might be losing and make sure those that are winning, again, we're spending those money, because the winner should be the students.
But if you don't know now exactly how you would make that happen, what would you say to somebody who says, okay, how long is it going to take you once you become governor to figure that out so that you could lead that effort?
Yeah. I could have the best laid out plan right here in front of me that I could tell you. And even if I told you it today, that's not going to be the results of what would pass, you know, 2-3 years from now. So again, it's having the determination, the grit to kind of push through getting that done, and the willingness to sit down, talk, and work with all the people involved to make it happen.
Would you raise teacher salaries if you were elected?
Yes.
By how much, do you know?
I don't know. Again, I had to look at the numbers, but to raise their salary and also to protect their retirement. There's been discussion out there about how the retirement plan is insolvent. Again, I don't mean to be too boring and talking about numbers or anything like that, but I'm diving into these reports, and I've looked at how we're managing our retirement plans. Before the big wave in the stock market, we had about $85 billion being managed by the state. We were paying $1.6 billion to administer that. That's an astronomically high number. We can cut that in half, if not more, put that into every year, putting it back into the fund to make sure it's solvent.
So you're saying that just by cutting administration costs, that would shore up the retirement system, which as baby boomers are retiring is only going to cost more.
Exactly.
Exactly. So can you cut those administration costs, though, and still ensure that the fund is managed properly?
Well, what I would like to do is, in cutting some of those funds, also allow some of those funds that we're saving to be invested in startup, more risky businesses. It might sound counterintuitive.
Is that what a retirement fund's supposed to do, though?
Well, it can. It can. Now, do we want 100% of the retirement fund to be in risky and startup businesses? Absolutely not. But to have 1% or 2% of the fund, yes, especially if they are being invested in Georgia businesses. Because the way that you really grow an economy is not by giving large companies big tax credits so they can move into our state. It's by supporting the small businesses, the new startups, the new ideas, the new products. And if we can have some of our teacher retirement fund, our employee retirement fund, investing in these new companies that could become the next Amazon or the next Facebook, all Georgians benefit.
Another thing that happened recently in the legislature right before adjournment was the Senate voting not to pass the House version of the Hidden Predator Act. This is a bill that would allow victims of child sex abuse more time to file lawsuits against the people that they say abused them. The House passed a bill that would, I think, give them up until age 38 to do that. The Senate had a different version. It didn't go along with the House version. You voted against going along with the House version. How come?
I voted for the bill every time it came up on the floor. The no vote that you're referring to was...
Which was the last one.
Was to suspend the rules of the Senate. And this was at 10:30 at night on the last day of session. And when you suspend the rules for the Senate to appoint a conference committee, that opens the door for anything and everything to happen. And while I absolutely want to protect the children out there, in doing so, we also have to protect everybody. And to suspend our rules when, again, had Casey done a better job
of managing
Governor
that? Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle.
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, had he done a better job managing that, the bill could have come up for a vote sooner in the day. The reason that we were voting to suspend the rules was because we have to have a conference committee report of the bill on our table for 2 hours. But the bill was not brought up until 10:30, so it would not give us enough time to actually read what the final bill was. So had it been brought up at 9:30 at night instead of 10:30 at night, we could have then had the conference committee and voted yes for it. So it was just mismanagement of the bill.
Two quick follow-ups to that, though. Number one, wasn't the principal difference a fairly simple one, just how much time the victims would have to sue? And number two, don't lawmakers vote quite often to suspend the rules to pick up bills that haven't been on their desks for 2 hours?
I don't suspend rules. Again, I'm not going to say what other law people members do, but it's not a good idea, and I frown upon suspending the Senate rules. And as far as the magnitude of the issues, I'm not the best to say whether or not it was a big. But to those that were affected, to those that might have been left out, I would say it probably was pretty significant.
Talking about transit for a moment, would you favor more state investment, not just the $100 million in bonds that are going so far, and not just say, okay, local governments, you can figure out whether you want to tax yourselves, but would you favor, say, a substantial state budget item for transit?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, I think we can accomplish spending more money in infrastructure without raising our taxes. Like I've said mm-hmm. already, we can cut waste. We can cut duplicity of services. I already talked about the governor's Office of Student Achievement. We can cut spending in some areas where we're not getting a benefit, put them in areas where we will get a much better benefit, one of those being transit.
But isn't the capital cost for transit, right-of-way acquisition, and just the construction so large that we're looking at something that you can't just cover by cutting waste because you'll have other things that are needed too?
Again, we have a $26 billion budget. $26 billion. When you include the money we get from the federal government, it approaches almost $50 billion. So we're not talking about chump change. This is a lot of money. And I 100% know that we can take care of the needs, the priorities that the state should take care of if we do a better job managing the money and the organizational structure that we have and putting those savings into transit. And also, right-of-way is extremely expensive in the Atlanta area.
Yeah.
It's not as expensive in the rural parts of Georgia. And about 30% of the traffic that goes through Atlanta is pass-through. So we need to develop a system that we can buy right away. We can build roads in the rural parts of Georgia to get this transit to not even go to Atlanta. So it would be cheaper that way as well.
Any particular type of transit? And let's just talk about the Atlanta area for now. Any particular type of transit that you think would be the most cost efficient and deliver the best service?
When you're talking about the Atlanta mass transit issue that we have, one of the biggest concerns that I have, what we need to focus on is, it's called that last mile. When you get off of MARTA, where do you go from there? And until we can develop, whether it's a bus, whether it's trolley, whatever that is, Uber, rideshare, people can get from the MARTA station to their final destination. Until we get that problem fixed, we don't need to extend the rail lines out any further, because all we'll be doing is bringing more people in to sit there, try to figure out where they need to go, and it's not going to be productive.
But isn't that a chicken or the egg question? Because it takes so long to develop a rail line, for instance, that by the time you figure out what your last mile is, if people don't know what the first mile is, you've already wasted time that you would need to get that going.
We have to come up with a solution of the last mile. We have to at least know what that is before we start investing. We can plan for the extension of MARTA. But before we start investing, we need to know what that solution is for that last mile.
On medical marijuana, you've called for state involvement in research and cultivation so that people who are able, because of their conditions, to get medical marijuana can actually get it, because right now they can't in the state, at least legally. How would that work, though?
One of the most heart-wrenching moments for me was 2014. I wasn't in the Senate yet. I went to sign die just kind of see what it was like. And the room, the Capitol, was filled with families, with children in wheelchairs, all in the hopes that medical marijuana was going to pass that night. It didn't. And the tears that were in these families' eyes, the sadness that just prevailed from that, it really sent a message to me that we have to do everything we can to make sure that we are able to provide the medicine, not just so that they can have it in their hand, but that they can have safe access to it. I have talked to countless families, moms, dads, that are trying to figure out, how do we get this medicine? Where do we go to? They had to break the law, fly out to Colorado, transport it back. That we need to be able to grow it here in the state. It needs to be highly regulated. So I'm not talking about somebody growing it in their backyard, but we have people that are licensed with the state that are highly regulated, so we can control who is growing it, as well as the safety, how safe that product is. I've talked to some people who get medical marijuana, and it ends up being bad, and it makes them even more sick. So we want to make sure that those families that need it, they get it, it's regulated, it's controlled, and it's safe access.
How would the licensing procedure work? I mean, would you limit it to, say, people connected with research universities, for instance, just to throw out an idea?
Yeah, that would be where we would like for it to fall, is with the university system. One of the dilemmas that we would have there, though, is if the university system is involved in growing marijuana, which is a Schedule I narcotic, are they going to lose any federal funds? So it's going to be that balance between how do we regulate it within the university system while not putting at risk the federal funds they might get.
Quick yes or no on this. What about legalizing recreational marijuana?
No.
In that case, though, there's a drive by some cities, including Atlanta, to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. It's not legal, but instead of being thrown behind bars, the person faces a fine up to a certain amount that they possess. Would you favor that?
One of the things I love about our country is the way we have it set up. States, cities, counties, they're able to experiment, if you will, with different laws, different rules. I personally am not in favor of that, but I would like to watch the city of Atlanta and see how that policy translates into public policy. And if it works for Atlanta, then I'd open to talk about it. But right now, no.
Let's talk quickly about immigration. I know that's a complicated area, but the state legislature recently adjourned without passing a bill that would require local jurisdictions to work with the federal authorities when someone is arrested. Again, they're not convicted, just arrested. Would you push for that as governor?
I would. In fact, I take it even a step further. What I am proposing as governor is there's a program called a 287G deportation program. What that is the counties, every single county around the state, can partner with ICE so that they can deputize several of their sheriff's deputies as acting ICE agents. So the moment that
is that even what sheriff's deputies have the time to do? In most local law enforcement departments, they're pretty burdened already.
Yes, and what are they burdened doing? Fighting crime, right? So if you find somebody that is in this country illegally breaking yet another law, how would it not benefit them to have the ability to put them on a bus and send them back where they came from to eliminate that element of crime in their county or their city?
There's a link that you and some other Republican candidates particularly have made between immigration and crime. And there was a recent study by the Marshall Project that found that in Atlanta, for instance, since 1980, while immigrant populations have soared, violent crime has gone down. And Doraville Police Chief John King just recently said that most of the violent gang members that you really have to worry about that have ties to the immigrant community were born here. They're citizens.
Yeah.
So why this link between immigration and crime when at least some data seem to indicate it's not really there, or not to the extent that a lot of folks who are running for governor say it is?
Well, again, the 287G deportation program, it doesn't add any extra burden onto the sheriff's department outside of just becoming compliant. Once you become compliant, then you're good to go. It's in the process of carrying out their duties. If they arrest somebody that is a gang member or not a gang member for breaking yet another crime, if that person is an illegal alien, they just have the ability to put them on the bus and send them back. So it's not making them go out and raid any homes or anything like that just because they think that they might be illegals in there. It's in the process of doing their job, they identify someone that's here illegally, they can send them back.
But this would be on arrest or on conviction?
Arrest.
Obviously, if they are here illegally, as you mentioned, they're already breaking a law. But what about the effect on the immigrant communities that you need to help cooperate with crime when you have somebody deported on arrest? It's one thing to say, okay, we're removing somebody who's a threat to the community because we know they've committed a crime, they've been convicted. But how can you expect to get help in finding those folks when some of your best sources in the immigrant community might be afraid, hey, if I'm even arrested for a broken taillight or whatever, I'll be deported?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned earlier, immigration is a very complex issue. And the 287G deportation program is not the end-all be-all. It's just one part of a much larger problem or fix to a problem. Federal, we have got to put pressure on the federal government to simplify the process to become a citizen, to allow ways for citizens, for people that want to become citizens, to give them that ability to. So as long as we're putting pressure on the federal government, working with us. Again, I completely support building the wall. Again, you know, we already talked about it. I'm a huge Trump fan. But I think all that working together will help make Georgia safer.
But the president also said there's not going to be any DACA deal. At least he said that recently. And isn't DACA one of the ways in which, as you mentioned, the process for people who want to become citizens could become easier?
Well, if you remember, his first deal with the Democrats was to give them more money than they wanted to begin with. And they still didn't work with them. So, you know, they get mad at him for not working with them. They get mad at him for giving them more than they wanted. They just like being mad at President Trump.
But there was the condition that they support the wall. So, I mean, there was more to it than just
there was
we're
a give
offering
and take.
You
yes.
money and
yes.
you said no.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the normal negotiation that goes on in the legislative process.
Yeah.
Confederate monuments. You said you'd oppose efforts to remove or relocate Confederate monuments and memorials. Would that apply to them all, though, or would you look at it case by case?
I have a pretty strong position on that, where all of them. I mean, that would apply to all of them.
Atlanta, for instance, though, has already established a commission to look at it. Shouldn't local governments and local communities make those decisions?
When you're talking about something as important as the history of our country, can the city of Atlanta decide if they want to abide by the Constitution? I support local control.
Are you equating Confederate monuments with the Constitution?
I am relating it to our history, and there are people out there that want to say that our Constitution, because our ancestors, because our founding fathers were racist, our Constitution is inherently racist. So, yes, I believe there's a direct connection between those that want to destroy our Confederate monuments also have a desire to destroy our Constitution. And I believe we need to stand up for our Constitution, for our history. I don't believe that we were perfect. We definitely made some bad decisions, but it is our history.
Two-part question on that, though. Georgia's been around for 230 years. The argument has been made, are we defining history by those 4 years of the Civil War or by the period of time afterward when most of those monuments went into place without any say by the people who had been enslaved? Are you saying that that's a complete view of history?
I think by eliminating those, you are erasing history. And so by no means am I saying that the Civil War is the beginning and ending of our country. Absolutely not. But it is a significant part of it. And to erase that would be a big injustice.
Some of the proposals involve not destroying the monuments or putting them away, but relocating them. Let's say in the town square, when you're trying to represent everyone, maybe move that statue and put it in another place where people can go see it, but at least not have it be the center of the town. Is that a reasonable thing?
It's not something that I support to say whether it's reasonable or not. That's debatable, but I don't support that.
Because you said it in your website even, it is time to unify Georgians. Mm-hmm. If you don't remove the Confederate memorials, let's assume you don't do that, then how would you propose to reach out to African Americans and others as governor who see those things as symbols of slavery and oppression and, in fact, a history written mostly up until now by white men?
Yeah. I definitely understand the significance of learning from our past, of having our history recorded. But at the same time, how we are going to unify and how we're going to make Georgia better is by looking to the future. And that's how I plan on uniting us, is what can we do in the 4 or 8 years that I'm governor to help us build better lives, have better education, enjoy being around each other more? You know, what kind of community events are we going to have? Different things like that. So looking to the future, not so much looking to the past.
You've pledged to support a so-called religious freedom bill. And many of your opponents on the GOP side have said the same, should it make it through the state legislature. The question, though, comes up, why sign a pledge, almost a blank check like that, when you don't even know what the language is going to be in that bill and whether it would survive a court test, for instance?
If I recall correctly, that actual pledge that I signed was very specific in what the bill would be, and it was the federal language that currently exists today. If a bill was passed, it had that same language, would I sign it? So I do know what was beyond there, It is the same bill that we're currently under right now, just on federal law. So would be no, well, there should be no court challenges on it because, again, federal law, that's what federal statute is. So I support it. And
what would you say to a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender person who sees, look, I just want to use a public accommodation. I'm not infringing on anyone's religious liberties. I'm not telling them what to believe. I just want to buy something from them.
I would say I agree with you in that there is a misconception about what this bill does. This bill will not stop the gay, the lesbian, any individual like that from going to a shop and buying flowers or buying a cake. It just allows those people that have a very firmly held religious belief to continue to exercise that.
We've talked a lot about what would happen if you win. One other question, if you win, which agenda items or initiatives of Governor Deal would you really work on continuing? And is there one or two that you would say, okay, that was Governor Deal's, I'm not going to pursue that one?
We talked about criminal justice reform, that making it so that's not a crime to be poor would definitely be something I would want to continue by the time I'm done being governor. If you can't afford a ticket, doesn't it need to be more expensive for you to pay a ticket by, you know, after you work with the state? So I'd like to continue that. The areas that I would differ, again, just going to be overall management running of the state. As the governor, you're the chief officer. It's your job to make sure the state is run well, and I'd focus on the operational side of the state government.
Real quickly on that subject of it's not a crime to be poor, would you consider eliminating cash bail, which, again, is something Atlanta has done?
Not right now, no.
Okay. Anything from Governor Deal's programs that you would think, oh, okay, that was Governor Deal's idea, but it's not at the top of my list?
The amount of tax credits. Again, Georgia become number one state in the country business because we continually throw money at big corporations. Again, I would want a state in which all business thrives, not where we're picking winners and losers.
That's what you would do if you win. If you lose this primary election or a runoff or whatever it turns out to be, would you support the eventual Republican nominee?
Let me come back
no
and answer that.
No matter who it is. I'm sorry, say that again?
Let me come back and answer that one.
Would depend on who it is.
I would want to make sure that we have the right person in office, and I believe very strongly it will be Republican. If there is one person, I would have a very hard time. But I'm not going to say it on air.
That was my recent conversation with Republican State Senator Michael Williams. He's one of the candidates trying to win his party's nomination to run for governor of Georgia. Now, make sure to keep an eye and an ear on our podcast feed for more interviews like this in the coming weeks. And look for those interviews Wednesdays and Fridays in our podcast feed. And don't forget to subscribe for more nourishing conversation all about Georgia politics. You can do that with your favorite podcast app. I'm Dennis O'Hare. I'll be back in your feed soon with more Political Breakfast.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.